couple of months ago, I received a phone call asking to give a talk in Rashard on Nehemiah. Then a couple days later, I looked at the high talks, and they were doing it on Nehemiah. So I called Mark and I said, you know, do you realize you're doing the same study in high that they're doing in Rashard? I said, the only reason why I know that is they asked me to speak on Nehemiah. And Mark, being the quick thinker that he is, said, oh, what chapters are you doing? You know, you could give the same talk again. I said, well, I just skimmed through it, and it looked like it was two chapters of names. I'm not really sure if I want to take on two gathering talks on these chapters. So I said, give me some time to think about it. He calls me back about a week later and says, I'm gonna send out the request, so if you want to get your name on that talk, you better put it in pretty quick. So he high-pressure sales me into taking this talk. But, you know, it's two chapters on names, and I'm thinking, it's in the Bible. There's got to be a reason that these chapters are here. And I'm not somebody that's good with names. I have a hard time remembering even people I work with. Or, you know, I have to think about people's names. I know who you are, but just the names don't come easy to me. And the scriptures, they just kind of seem to get all jumbled up in my head. And I have a real tough time with it. So I said, how am I going to do this? So I just did a search in the Bible for the words book, life, and name. And Philippians 4, verse 3 came up. And I treated thee also, true yoke fellow. Help those women which labor with me in the gospel, with Clement also, and with other my fellow servants, whose names are written in the book of life. The names written in the book of life. We know that the Bible is the only book that gives life. And these people's names are written in there. Now, whether Paul was talking about a literal book of life that people in his day, the angels or God is keeping record of, or just a mental record that God's keeping, it's still the same. That the work that we do is going to be recorded, and God is going to know our name in our works. How much harder would we listen to the names that were read before us today if it was Christ or an angel standing up here reading who made it into the kingdom? We were waiting to hear if our name was on that list. All the work that was done in the city to rebuild it. And God was highlighting the names of the people that were moving into this newly finished city. It's not always the mighty acts of war that God records in His Word. The great military victories of Joshua, Samson, and David. These people were working to support and to grow the work of God simply by moving their house to a new location. But was this move so simple? In the first two verses of the first chapter, it talks about the repopulation of the city. They moved into the city and moved away from wherever they had settled. And this was probably a great sacrifice. Think about it if we put ourselves in their shoes. We had to pick up everything we owned, quit our job, and move to a town that no one lived in yet. We might consider moving to a city with work and no ecclesia before we would consider moving to a place with ecclesia that we hadn't found work yet. But it's not that there was no work there. There was lots of work to still be done. It was that there was no paying work. there was a lot of work that they had to do in upkeeping the city. The city was now finished, the wall was now finished, but it would not last unless the people would continue in maintaining it. There would be no source of income for these people, as there was no commerce or anything really going on in there. So the people were supported by tithing. In Nehemiah 7, verse 4, we read, "Now the city was large and great, but the people were few therein, and the houses were not builded." In verse 2, it talks about they willingly offered. Have we ever been part of something that we had to plan? The bigger the thing is, the harder it is to plan. The more people we have to consider, arrange for, how are they getting in, where are they going to stay, it's tough to do. Yet if we have people coming up, stepping up, and helping out, it can make the job a much easier thing. On the other hand, if we have people not doing their job, even though it might be a small job, it's one more job that somebody else will have to do. And instead of helping out, we might be the one sitting in the back complaining about things, doing the bare minimum. And that makes it even tougher. But suppose that we are one willing to help out and volunteer. When do we volunteer to help? Is it something that we do when we feel that we're good at this position, that we can showcase our skills? But what if it's not something we're very good at? Are we going to get in there and help out? Or are we going to just say, "No, that's not my thing," and leave it for somebody else to do, or leave it undone? These people are listed in these chapters for the work that they committed. We see that the city was built and populated so that it would last. We are given their names. So now, what do we do with these names? H.P. Mansfield is always giving the definitions of names in his exhortation. And I would hear them and hear his reasonings, and I say, "Well, that makes sense, but it's probably just a stretch." But then one time I was listening to one of his talks, and he was saying that God has these people and uses their names to add another dimension for understanding and a lesson to us. Now, I'm not saying that we can build first principles off of people's names, as we discussed yesterday, where some people's names show that they had a godly name, but in truth they were working against Nehemiah. But there are lessons, and to say that God isn't having a hand in this work and is simply just a coincidence isn't consistent with saying that God's work is wholly inspired in His Word. So I think that these names do have a meaning. I'm not going to go into all these names, as I went through and looked up most of these names, and some of them were listed in other chapters of Nehemiah where they're simply just names, but there's a couple of them that we will look at. But we'll, in verse 4, the 11th chapter, we'll just look at verse 4 and 5. Athaliah, his name means Yah helps, the son of Uzziah, the strength of Yah, the son of Zechariah, Yah hath remembered, the son of Amariah, Yah hath promised, the son of Shephaniah, Yah hath judged, the son of Mahael, praise ye El. The children of Pezer, which is Pharez, and his name means breach. Do any one of these names seem out of place? They are all talking about God's help, strength, His remembrance of His promise, thinking about how they would again return into the land that they were cast out of because of their unbelief. It's talking about judgment, praise. Webster gives the definition of praise is an expression of approval. And then we have breach. Webster says an infraction or violation of law, or broken or torn. All these names seem to be showing that how God has helped them, strengthened them in finishing the building of the city, and remembered the promise of freeing them from their captivity in Babylon and the Medo-Persian empires, judging them worthy to return to the land that God has blessed them with. But having a breach would make the wall that they built no good. It would make it worthless. If somebody could break through that breach, then all the rest of the wall, as good and strong as it was, wouldn't help them. So why does this name appear here? Was it because God knew that they again would turn to their own ways and be cast out and driven from the land? Or was it because there's always a way in? If we ask for repentance and serve God again with a mind that we readjust to His Word, and will He create a breach to allow us to enter again the protection of His walls? This might be something that we can discuss after. In verse 5, Maaseiah, his name means a work or activity of Yah. Yahweh is the living God. He is over all the actions of the earth. The son of Barak, the Blessed One. Blessing by keeping the people separate and letting them return to the land after 70 years of captivity in Babylon. The son of Kohozel, all-seeing. Although at times of trouble and tough times may feel that we are all alone, God sees all. So we will never be alone unless we are the ones to turn our back on Him. The son of Hazael, Yah has seen. God remembers our works. So although our reward might not come as quickly as we would like to see it, God has seen it, and we will receive our reward, whatever that is, whether we are accepted into the kingdom or denied. The son of Adaiah, whom Yah adorns. Adorns means to make beautiful. We are tested and tried, like the purified gold. We are made more beautiful by the fire. So our characters should be made more beautiful with the trials that we go through. The son of Joiarib, Yahweh contends. All the people in the surrounding nations did not want Israel to complete the wall. These nations were not allowed to succeed over Israel because God was on Israel's side. This is something that as we go through our trials, we must remember. The son of Zechariah, Yah hath remembered. God remembers all that is done. The only way that God is ever going to forget something is if we pray for forgiveness and it is granted to us. The son of Shai-Onai, it has another translation, has a Shulamite. signifies the sent one. We are all here because we have been called by God. We are working, sent out to be a light to this world. How busy are we in that world? Do we allow the light to shine as bright as it should be? Or are we too busy with our own lives to even be a flicker in the darkness? All the sons of Pharez. And this is one of the few names that, when I went through and looked up all these names, that actually I could find anything about. And if we turn to Genesis 38 and verse 24, we'll read. And it came to pass 3 months after that it was told Judah, saying, Tamar thy daughter-in-law hath played the harlot. And also, behold, she is with the child by whoredoms. And Judah said, bring her forth and let her be burned. It's kind of fitting with the reading that we had before with David and how quick he was to condemn until he realized it was him. And when she brought forth, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the man whose these are, I am with child. And she said, discern, I pray thee, who these are, the signet and bracelet and staff. And Judah acknowledged them and said, she hath been more righteous than I, because that I gave her not to Shelah, my son. And he knew her not again, and he knew her again no more. And it came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in her womb. And it came to pass when she travailed that one put out his hand, and the midwife took and bound upon his hand the scarlet thread, saying, this came out first. And it came to pass, as he drew back his hand, that behold, his brother came out. And she said, how hast thou broken forth? This breach be upon thee. Therefore his name was called Pharez. And afterwards came out his brother, that had the scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was Zerah. So we see this Pharez, the breach. He had such a tough start. You figure his mother played the harlot. His father was, should have really been his grandfather. And so many times, especially being a teacher, you hear, well, this kid has this kind of upbringing, and we're so quick to blame everything else. But we see that he was somebody that did not allow these things to bother him, and he became a great family in Israel. His family is listed in the genealogies of Christ, both in Matthew 1 and Luke chapter 3. So he is in both Joseph and in the line of Joseph and Mary. And his family is also in the captains of the host that at the time of David. And also with Ruth, they wanted her to be blessed like the house of Pharez. So his family was a prominent family throughout the Israel's history. This scarlet thread was tied to show the firstborn because of the benefits that came with being a firstborn in Israel. But if we look at the history, God did not always choose the oldest, but the one that was a true follower. We cannot take pride in our genealogy or our birth order, as Israel did. It is only our service to God and His mercy that can get us into the kingdom. Think about the lineage of Christ and the names that appear in there. Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, Bathsheba, Mary. Not names that normally we would want to be proud of and brag about in Israel. But because of faith, these names were mentioned. Nehemiah 11, verse 12. They offered sacrifice and burnt incense and set on the showbread, lighting the lamps. So these guys did the work of the temple. You think about all the priests and Levites. There was a lot of work to be done. In Nehemiah, in the 14th verse, it talks about them being valiant. If we look up in Strong's into valiant, we see that it talks about strength, ability, efficiency, wealth, and a force of army. Yet we're not talking about Judah or Benjamin, but we're talking about the tribe of Levi. These men were strong and valiant in the service of the temple, fighting for the service of the Word of God. Is that how we would describe ourselves in our service to God? Can we say that we are valiant for the work of the truth? Nehemiah 16 talks about the outward service. They had to take care of everything, the repairs and upkeep of the temple. And this would include the getting of the wood for the altar and collecting the shekel to purchase things that they needed in the temple. It was not only the preaching that is needed. If we look at a gathering, we say, well, the talks were good, but what if there was no food? Would we be concentrating on the talks or on how our stomachs are growling and how hungry we are? I know that's probably never happened at a Christadelphian gathering, but... Or what if there was no benches to sit on and we had to stand while we were listening to the talks? Or a bad smell coming from the bathrooms because nobody wanted to go back there and clean them? Or the trash didn't get picked up on the grounds? These aren't major jobs to be done, but there are jobs that have to be done. If we are not working, then we don't realize sometimes how much work is required because it just seems to get done. Yet if someone is skipping their job, then you're requiring somebody else to work twice as hard. And that is true with our work in the truth. Nehemiah, in the 17th through the 19th verse, talks about how they are led in song at the time of daily sacrifice, and the prayer was made. Many of them had songs and hymns. Then it talks about the porters of the gates and the gatekeepers. Going a little bit long here. So again, if we talk about the gathering, we have the bell ringers and the organists, the presiders. They help to keep us on track. So are we ready and watching and helping others to be ready around us, as Mattaniah did here in this verse? It also has Zeriah, who was in this chapter, who was Pharez's twin brother, who had the scarlet thread put on him. Someone had to ask a favor of the king and petition it. It would go to Zeriah, and Zeriah would deliver the petition to the king, and then the king would either grant it or not, and then he would return it. So he was kind of like the mediator between Israel and the king. In the 12th chapter, it's the dedication of the wall. It talks about the priest and the genealogies. They had to prove that they were who they said they were in order to perform those jobs. The Levites, it talks about them being over against them in their watch. So they were... had to be relieved. There was in watches or shift work. You don't think of it. You think of the temple, just everybody went home and then the next day they started it up. But there was a lot of work to be done, and that would go on. So they would work nonstop. We think of Eli And when he was older, the candlestick went out because they were not keeping up with the work in the temple. And it talks about some of them being around about Jerusalem. So some of the singers lived in the cities so as to have them readily available for the access to the temple. Talks about the purification of themselves, the people, the gates, and the walls. So not only did the leaders have to be purified, the people have to be purified, but also the things. It is all God's. It is not our life, and it is not our stuff. If we don't purify the things that we have in our lives to God, then even these inanimate objects can cause defilement and lead us away from God. And then it talks about the two great companies on the wall. The fact that they could have these parades walking across, one on one side of the wall headed clockwise, the other headed counterclockwise. They were mocked not too long ago, saying if a fox ran across this wall that it would crumble, in Nehemiah 4:3. Yet now two great companies march across this wall and meet on the other side. These companies, one under Ezra and the other under Nehemiah, walked in opposite directions, meeting nearly midway around on the eastern wall between the water and the prison gates outside the temple. What a show of accomplishment this must have been. And then the chapter finishes up with the terms of the covenant and implementation. Again, showing the jobs needed to be done and the finances that were required to keep the city going. We cannot think that simply because we have finished the work, we can sit back and watch as the only thing that we will see is the collapse of the work that we have done. Our work in the truth is never done. And just as Nehemiah was trying to convey to the people in his day, we must always be working as servants for God.